Well, Monday, a bunch of things happened in your little town here. It was the second term inauguration of Barack Obama. It was Martin Luther King Day. We're coming upon the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. There's really a lot to reflect on of kind of great value. And sadly, in that same kind of note, when we look around the world, what we see is just continuing conflict after continuing conflict. There's concerns about the environment, concerns about climate change, concerns whether this planet can continue to sustain 7 billion plus of us in the manner of which we're used to living. And then there's the current financial issues that have pervaded the world. So with so much to consider, our species can use all the wise leaders that it can muster. There was a Gallup poll in 1999, the end of the millennium, and people were asked, who were the most admired people in the 20th century? Who do you suppose was in the top five? Just shout out any name you think might be in the top five. Gandhi, FDR, Elvis, Martin Luther King, Clinton. Gene Goodall. Okay. Some great names. Some of these people I think are on the list farther down. But number one on the list was Mother Teresa. Number two was Martin Luther King. Three was JFK. Einstein was fourth. And Helen Keller was fifth. That's kind of interesting. Three of the top five, they're mostly known for their compassion. Now, I think if Mr. Gallup had been conducting these polls in the 5th century BCE, maybe the Buddha would have made the list. Don't know for sure. But tonight I want to reflect on the work of Martin Luther King and Siddhartha Gautama, also known as the Buddha. There's strong similarities in the teachings in both of them. So it's understood by scholars as Buddhism has migrated from northern India to other areas in Southeast Asia, into China, into Tibet, that it picked up various flavors of the times and cultures that it's landed in. And this process is certainly continuing as Buddhism comes to the West. I mean, our culture is very scientific and very psychological, so we can already begin to see how that's beginning to shape Buddhism here in our culture. But I want to reflect, I want to go back a little bit in history and reflect for a moment on how Buddhism adapted to conditions in Vietnam. Buddhism was greatly affected by the war in Vietnam that basically began with the French and then continued with the U.S. involvement. It's a little history for those who may be interested or don't know. Prior to World War II, Vietnam was a French colony. During the war, because France was occupied by Germany, they basically lost a lot of the control of a lot of their colonies. I mean, they didn't have their organizational structure. So after the war, they wanted to reestablish their empire as best they could. Well, the people in Vietnam had a different idea of how they'd like to move ahead in the future. And so from 1945 to 1954, there was a war in Vietnam. And close to 100,000 French were killed, 150,000 Vietnamese were killed. And a peace treaty was signed in 1954. And that peace treaty stipulated that the country was divided in half. There was going to be a communist north and a quasi-free South Vietnam. But within 2 years, there was going to be elections to decide whether they were going to reunite the country or not. The United States backed the South Vietnamese government that was established there. But after 2 years, the South Vietnamese government decided, well, we don't really want to have elections. Tensions then began creeping up again. This is 1956. We started sending advisors to that government in the late 50s, and John Kennedy sent the first troops there in the early 60s. And the rest you know about. The war ended in 1975, when Vietnam was reunited. Now, the upshot of all this carnage that the people of Vietnam experienced, they experienced almost 30 years of continuous war on their soil. And that affected the practices and the philosophy of Buddhism in that culture. It was kind of interesting. There was this Vietnamese Buddhist youth organization that sprang up during the 50s and 60s, and their motto was Bi Tri Dung, which means compassion, wisdom, and courage. And that organization continues to this day. And I'm not sure, but Thich Nhat Hanh might have been involved with that organization when he was a monk there. So in the midst of all of this, it's a little different than the way that we conceive the metaphor that we use here in the West, where we usually talk about the dove. Well, the two wings of the dove, wisdom and compassion, and it takes both wings to take flight. But due to the severe conditions in Vietnam, they added courage along with the wisdom and compassion. And when I reflect on the life of Dr. King, we could certainly say that his life expressed a very mature integration of compassion, wisdom, and courage. And if we want to consider Buddhist practices in relation to the conditions that we face today in the United States or in the West or in the world, I mean, here in the United States, we're entering our 10th year of war overseas. We are now threatening to attack Iran almost on a regular basis. And then we've got all our usual concerns about the environment and the economy. Excellent as they are, wisdom and compassion may not be adequate enough to meet the challenges that we're facing here. Much courage may be needed by all of us. So let's look at the work of Dr. King in relation to the Dharma. And it was a very eerily prophetic interview that he gave just before he was shot in Memphis in 1968. He was asked how he'd like to be remembered at his funeral. Actually, that's a nice exercise for all of us to do. How would you like to be remembered at your funeral? And he said this. He said, rather than his awards and where he went to school, people should talk about how he fought peacefully for justice. I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving others. I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. I want you to say that day that I tried to be right on the war question. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try to feed the hungry. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try in my life to clothe those who were naked. I want you to say on that day that I did try in my life to visit those who were in prison. And I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. And yes, if you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness. And all the other shallow things will not matter. Quite a life's intention. To love, to reach out to those who are suffering, and to simply stand up for what is fair. Now, Dr. King paralleled the Buddha's teaching about love as the foundation for peace and social justice. Dr. King said this, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate can't drive out hate. Only love can do that." And the Buddha said this, "Hatred can never cease by hatred. Only by love can hatred cease." And in a Gary Larson cartoon, I forgot to bring it with me, but it's in my head. It takes place in hell, okay? And there's this kind of nice matronly woman there, and she's got a platter, and on the platter there's milk and cookies. And there's a row of people sitting on a bench, and she's handing them milk and cookies. But she's interesting because she has some horns, and out of the bottom of her dress you can see the spiked tail. So these people are there. And then there's, in the other part of the cartoon, there's this door, and it's obviously Satan has come busting through the door because, you know, he's got the goatee and everything, and he's got the horns, and he's got the cloak and everything. And all these flames are coming out of this door behind him. And he's screaming, "No, no! Gosh darn it, Mom! Stop offering milk and cookies to the doomed!" You know? So there can be love everywhere. Dr. King, love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. And those of you who've been coming here and maybe going to retreats and studied some Buddhism, you know that the Buddha taught loving kindness. That's just basically the quality of friendliness and care extended to all beings. That's friendliness and care extended to all beings, not just a selected few, without discrimination. I mean, the classic loving kindness practice generally begins with extending care to ourselves, and of course that's hard for Westerners right there with all our self-concept and stuff that we do to ourselves, but kind of starting there and then moving it to loved ones and then maybe picking out people that have helped us during life, benefactors. And then it gets more and more challenging as we go to, oh, people different than us. And what about people that are difficult for us? You know, it's a lifetime of gradually expanding our capacity to love. It's a wonderful practice, and it's not so easy to extend this friendliness without discrimination. This from Mary Oliver. On cold evenings, my grandmother, with ownership of half her mind, the other half having flown back to Bohemia, spread newspapers on the porch floor So, she said, the garden ants could crawl beneath as under a blanket and keep warm. And what shall I wish for myself? But being so struck by the lightning of years, to be like her with what is left, that loving. Reminds me of something I read. Someone was talking about, I think they were talking about their parent who had Alzheimer's. But this was a very loving person who had just spent their whole life kind of giving and loving and had really cultivated it such that it was right down in the nervous system. And people would come to the door and they would have no recognition of who this person was. It's like they'd come to the door and they'd open, and the person would be standing there, and it could be, you know, one of their children or anybody. And they'd say, look, I don't know who you are, but I'm glad to see you, and you're welcome here. You know, there was something going on that had been cultivated that, at least in this case, continued to work its way through the terrible suffering of Alzheimer's. And again, from Dr. King, a slightly different angle. We must develop and maintain the capacity to forgive. He who is devoid of the power to forgive is devoid of the power to love. There is some good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us. When we discover this, we are less prone to hate our enemies. You could say that forgiveness is one of the nuances of loving kindness practice, in a way, in that big umbrella. But it's a practice that's best approached in its own time, incrementally. I mean, can we forgive the driver who maybe cut us off today? Okay? Maybe we reflect for a moment on they must be having a really rough day and they're harried and there's chaos and maybe there's some fear. And we can kind of move to forgive them with a little work. Then the challenge comes, can we turn to those who have hurt us and betrayed us very personally in our life? Most of us have suffered in some way at the hands of others. That becomes a little more challenging to work with it. And I know a big one, I've been working on one for 23 years, actually, forgiveness. It was a time in my life where everything was kind of coming unglued and I was taken advantage of in a business transaction that cost me a pretty good stack of money, and I had worked really hard. And three people kind of conspired and didn't tell the truth, and things didn't work out. So I've been working with that forgiveness for 23 years. And there are times when I think, you know, it's like I'm free. I'm okay. But it's a small town, Charlottesville, and these people have some power, and so their names appear in the newspaper. And then I can feel that clutch in my heart, that kind of like, you know, like I'm still separate. I'm not completely worked through with this. And I'm sure you all have your instances, or many of you do. Maybe some of you are just totally, completely forgiving all the way down to the depths of everyone who's ever harmed you in your life. So the cultivation of a heart of forgiveness can't be forced. It's a gentle cultivation. You know, and some of these things, it's a lifetime of reflecting on and going back to. And maybe it's more than a lifetime if you believe in that, you know, that we go on. It's from Dr. King. He says, there's a couple of quotes here. At the center of nonviolence stands the principle of love. And he says, the force for change must come from love. The force for change must come from love. And he says this, and he's kind of talking about the power of loving kindness. Now, there is a final reason, I think, that Jesus says, love your enemies. It is this, that love has within it a redemptive power, and there is a power there that eventually transforms individuals. Just keep being friendly to that person. Just keep loving them, and they can't stand it too long. Oh, they react in many ways in the beginning. They react with guilt feelings, and sometimes they'll hate you a little more at that transition period. But just keep loving them. And by the power of your love, they will break down under the load. That's love, you see. It is redemptive. And this is why Jesus says, love. There's something about love that builds up and is creative. And there is something about hate that tears down and is destructive. So love your enemies. And you can see how he manifested that in his life over and over. So Dr. King believed, just as the Buddha did, that the other side of nonviolence is love. And that love is central as the basis for any action. And it's not a weak force, it's powerful. In metta practice, in loving kindness practice, we incline the heart towards this friendliness, towards love, over and over again. It's an intention. I don't always get there, but I can often remember the intention to care, to love, to be friendly. That's the metta practice, that's the loving kindness practice. This from Albert Einstein. Remember, he was number 4 in the Gallup poll? A human being is part of a whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, as a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Widening our circles of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. And this from Dr. King, his letter from a Birmingham jail, which he wrote in 1963. At that point, he had come out against the war. And that's early, because there wasn't much of a war movement in 1963, an anti-war movement. There was some rudiments of it, but it wasn't what it turned into. And so a lot of his clergy brethren that were involved in civil rights said, Martin, what are you doing? You know, don't pick up this other issue. Stay focused on civil rights here in America and let this other stuff go. And naturally, of course, not only that, but a lot of the people that were sympathetic to him on some level when he came out against the war, he lost those people also. So he was under a lot. And so he writes part of what he wrote. It's a fabulous letter. It's lengthy. I'm just going to read a little excerpt. But if you get a chance, you might want to read it. And he says this, moreover, or he writes this, moreover, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned with what what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. In Buddhism, the core wisdom teaching is the teachings around the roots of suffering and the roots of freedom, the Four Noble Truths. And the first of the Four Noble Truths is the truth of suffering or stress or unsatisfactory, you know, in certain aspects of our life. You know, you get born, things are going to happen. You didn't read the fine print when you were signing up to get to land on this planet that said, oh my gosh, you're going to get old and sick and die and you're going to lose people and things are going to go wrong. You didn't read that, but it was there. And the second noble truth is that, hey, there's a cause for certain aspects of this suffering. Desperately clinging to what we like, you know, trying to hold on to something that we discover that we like, to make it stand still in the face of constant change. Nature doesn't work like that. Nature is moving all the time. This planet is based on impermanence. Nature's foundational aspect is impermanence. When we grasp onto something and try to keep it like it is, that's a losing game. It really is. I've heard it described as, you know, trying to hold on to things. It's like getting rope burned because everything's moving. That's on one hand. And then the things we don't like, we can exhaust ourselves by thrashing around and trying to get rid of them all the time and manipulating our environment endlessly, endlessly, endlessly for more and more comfort. It's exhausting. And the third noble truth is, hey, there can be an end to this suffering. It's by letting be, letting go. Releasing that clinging. And letting up on some of that thrashing around, trying to get rid of things that are unpleasant. And the fourth noble truth is there's a path that teaches us and supports us in letting go and cultivating greater wisdom, greater understanding, a greater perspective, and cultivating a greater heart. Love and compassion. And that path leads to the end of suffering. It's called the Eightfold Path. I'm not going to go into that tonight. So this practice, it's not so much that we have difficulty, that we have physical and emotional pain, that we have loss. The practice is around what's our reaction to these facts of life. You know, it's the way that we struggle and have difficulty being with what's unpleasant. There's a tendency, if our hearts and minds haven't been cultivated or trained, that we're just operating on reaction. We just go off, flying off, one way or the other. But as we learn to develop, to cultivate and develop the capacity to like actually be with our own difficulties, our own sufferings for a little while, a strength of heart really develops, a confidence, a capacity. Hey, I can be with this. I can do this. It's a poem by Roshani. There is a brokenness out of which comes the unbroken, a shatteredness out of which blooms the unshatterable. There is a sorrow beyond all grief, which leads to joy, and a fragility out of whose depths emerges strength. There is a hollow space, too vast for words, through which we pass with each loss, out of whose darkness we are sanctioned into being. There is a cry, deeper than all sound, whose serrated edges cut the heart as we break open to the place inside which is unbreakable and whole while we learn to sing. Many of you know the Buddha's concept of the second arrow. But it's a good one to keep in the front of your mind. You know, we all hear it, we know it, but like remembering it on a, you know, daily basis is really helpful. Because the mind has no shame. It will punish us in different ways. So everyone gets the first arrow of life. I just talked about that. Throughout life, we get all kinds of first arrows, various hurts, woundings, losses of all kinds. That's the first arrow. It's not seen as a problem. It's seen as being human. It's the proliferation of the mind that comes after this first arrow. That's what exacerbates the suffering or the pain of the first arrow. That can be the problem. A couple of years ago, I had a severe knee pain. And so I thought, well, I'll rest it. But it didn't get any better. In fact, it got worse. And I couldn't get an appointment for a number of weeks with this all-too-popular doctor that everybody goes to. He's an osteopath or something like that. He calls himself a joint jiggler. But he's kind of a mystical character in Charlottesville that everyone goes to when they got things wrong in their joints, especially. If I was unmindful, and these weeks are going by, I don't know what's wrong, it's getting worse, it's hurting more. The mind would take the bare experience of this strong sensation, or you could call it pain, and proliferate all manner of doom stories, you know. I think, oh, could this be like the beginning of rheumatoid arthritis? My mother had arthritis. Boy, that could be really crippling. And geez, as a young man, decades ago, I had bone cancer. No sign of it, but could this be a return? And then, my knee. It's so important. I love exercising. It's part of my kind of mental well-being. And if I lose this knee, if it's some degenerative, unfixable necrosis like Bo Jackson had, you know, in his knees, well then, what am I going to do without exercise? Boy, that's a big adjustment, you know. And then the mind just won't let up, you know, if we're not mindful, you know. You know, if the pain keeps increasing like this, well, then I've got to get some painkillers, you know? And might I get hooked on painkillers, you know? And if I get hooked on painkillers, what about my level of lucidity? You know, I kind of earn my living trying to be lucid and teaching, you know? And if that goes, you know, well, okay, well, then no money's coming in. Well, then the house kind of goes. And then, you know, I end up under the overpass, you know, on painkillers, zonked out of my mind, or maybe behind the railway station, you know, in the alley there. So you see what the mind can do. And okay, I exaggerated a little bit for effect, but you get the idea. And you've all had this experience. You know, the first arrow was just the pain in the knee. It's just strong sensation. But the second, third, fourth, fifth arrows, that's the mind proliferating on and on and on. You know? But with some training in mindfulness practice, a little meditation practice that maybe gets some traction. There's an awareness. There's an earlier and earlier awareness of what's going on with this mind. Oh, now I see what's happening. You know, I have this sensation. And then the mind is linking one thing after the other after the other. But we don't have to follow it. If we can recognize what's going on in a gentle way, just say, oh, I just don't need to follow this out. No, thank you. I'm not going there now. I know this is a dead end. It solves nothing. It's not creative. And it makes me feel worse. In fact, I read somewhere where doctors say that 80% of what is actually felt is not physically there. It's not physically being. It's the contraction around the pain. You know, it's like that's why they give you out those tens units when you tear a muscle in your back, because all the muscles around the actual spot who are uninjured are like contracting around it. Well, we do that emotionally also. So that second arrow, you know, it's part of the benefit of a spiritual training like this, or a meditation practice, an awareness practice, a mindfulness practice. We just get to see things earlier and earlier. And then we have a choice. You know, and sometimes we shoot that second arrow at ourselves, and sometimes we shoot it at others. Through blaming and lashing out at others in some way. You know, we can't quite stand the uncomfortableness, the unpleasantness, and so we blame, or we react in some way. You know, a coworker might say something unkind, and we fire right back. Then they come back at us. Then we come back at them. And then we've established the cycle. You know, it's a cycle of ill feeling or kind of verbal violence. And that creating a feud that could simmer for years. And I don't even want to talk about families. Think about the feuds in families. You know, they go on for decades. All because we're so uncomfortable with that first arrow. We push back. You know, we get hurt and we strike back. So it is an important part of this training to learn how not to shoot that second arrow at ourselves or at other people. To learn how to be with the unpleasant without reactivity. And it doesn't mean we're doormats. That's not it. It's about a skillful response. And it's certainly natural if you've had violence done to you that you want to hurt back. Dr. King says this: returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. And again he says, hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that. He says, have we not come to such an impasse in the modern world that we must love our enemies or else? The chain reaction of evil, hate begetting hate, wars producing more wars, must be broken, or else we shall be plunged into the dark abyss of annihilation. He didn't mince his words. Hate begetting hate. I often reflect on the aftermath of 9/11. Yes, it was extremely important to bring the perpetrators to justice. And it was very important to increase the power and sophistication of our intelligence gathering, working in concert with all the other nations in the world to stop these kind of activities before they get started. But I keep reflecting, was it prudent to invade two countries? Did the invasion of two primarily Muslim countries radicalize legions of terrorists and their supporters to the detriment of the entire world? And what will the long-term effects be? Was this another instance of a cycle of violence begetting more and more violence? I mean, time and the unfolding of history will reveal the effects more completely. And I don't pretend to think that I know where all this is going and what was correct and incorrect. Dr. King always addressed violence with love and understanding and a refusal to inflict further injury. Dr. King said, "Wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows." Wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows. Breaking the cycle of violence is a challenging teaching. I mean, we can see it manifesting in our relationships day to day. That's that little tit for tat, tit for tat. And even in the negative, harsh attitudes that we have towards ourselves. And gosh, look at the news. Anytime, any day, and we see firsthand what Dr. King, Buddha, Gandhi, and many others have been teaching, have been talking about. A Zen master was dying, and his students came to him and asked for his final words to clarify them what their spiritual practice was all about. What is Zen, they asked. And those of you who have studied Zen know that it can be pretty obtuse at times. You know, it's beautiful, it's aesthetic, and it's obtuse. They wanted a clear answer before he cut out on them. You know, he was dying, he was the master, and they were like, kind of, what am I doing? And he said this, Zen is the appropriate response to the moment. Zen is the appropriate response to the moment. Dr. King, the Buddha, I believe responded appropriately in the times that they lived. But that's our challenge too. Individually, collectively, to every situation, what is the appropriate response? Whether we're dealing with our children, or whether we're looking at some collective issue, the economy or the environment, etc. And Dr. King's appropriate response was, in almost all cases, wise, compassionate, and courageous. Very inspirational for millions. It's not easy. You can't be fooled. If you want to be more than a spiritual hobbyist, it takes a lot of courage to take up a spiritual practice. To look deeply inside first. To stand in there and look at our own reactivity and conditioning. And some of it may not be very pretty. And one teacher said, self-knowledge is often bad news. You know? But to learn to turn toward and directly experience our suffering without turning away. to stand in with our own suffering. And then to turn outward and to be able to be and learn to be with others in a compassionate way when they are suffering in the depths of their struggles. It's a lot to ask. And this requires a lot of courage. And bringing this practice into the world often meets with tremendous resistance. To speak honestly what needs to be said. Dr. King, Gandhi, Jesus, and many others over the course of history lost their lives. They're killed for their efforts. As they struggled to bring just a sense of justice to the world. And even the Buddha met tremendous resistance. The way he was operating his order was directly against the caste system 2,500 years ago in India. He got a lot of resistance. And an attempt was made on his life by his cousin. King said this shortly before his death. Really speaks to the courage that pulsed through his veins. You may be 38 years old, as I happen to be, and one day some great opportunity stands before you and calls you to stand up for some great principle, some great issue, some great cause. And you refuse to do it because you are afraid. You refuse to do it because you want to live longer. You're afraid that you will lose your job, or you are afraid that you will be criticized, or that you will lose your popularity, or you're afraid that somebody will stab you, or shoot at you, or bomb your house. So you refuse to take the stand. Well, you may go on and live until you are 90, but you're just as dead at 38 as you would be at 90. And the cessation of breathing in your life is but the belated announcement of an earlier death of the spirit. If we can remember and cultivate intentions that point us towards an appropriate response, a response that holds within it wisdom, a response that holds within it compassion, a response that holds within it courage, and bring just the best of our ability to that. If we can remember those three, wisdom, compassion, and courage, bringing that to every situation, to the best of our ability. I want to read one more quote from Dr. King. "Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up on the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we, as a people, will get to the promised land. And I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. So I'd like to end tonight and play an excerpt from maybe his most famous speech, I Have a Dream. And I won't comment after that because I can't comment after that. So just sit back, maybe close your eyes. It's about 5 minutes, a little less. And allow the full import of the man's wisdom, his compassion and courage, just kind of rattle around inside.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
Yes.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Yes.
I have a dream that one day,
yes,
this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
Yes.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Thank you for your attention.